During the Right Rug Flooring Anniversary Sale, we're celebrating 91 years of the guaranteed lowest prices. With beautiful carpet with a lifetime stain warranty starting at $219 a square foot installed with pad. And luxury vinyl starts at $399 a square foot installed. Unbeatable prices and 24-month special financing available with approved credit. Schedule a free in-home appointment with our flooring experts at RITERUG.com. Right Rug Flooring's Anniversary Sale. Right.
CODA salutes those who served. Veterans ride free Tuesday, November 11th. And every other day of the year, our veterans and active duty military personnel get a 50% discount on all fares. It's all part of CODA's ongoing commitment to show appreciation for your selfless service. To ride at no cost on fixed routes, tell your bus operator that you're a veteran or use code VET2025 in the app to use CODA Plus. Veterans ride free on Tuesday, November 11th for Veterans Day. Veterans get a 50% discount every day on CODA. Plan your ride and learn more at coda.com/trip planner.
Hi folks, how you doing? You're like, hold on a minute, it's middle of the week, what's Bowman doing here chatting to us about random film, TV and music stuff? Well, as promised, we have a bonus episode of Soundtracking for you this week as the brilliant Charlie Brooker joins me to discuss the inimitable Black Mirror. So all six episodes of the new season are available to watch on Netflix now, and they don't disappoint. As you'll hear Charlie talk about, you know, as he moves through this show and tries to think of different ways and different things to do, it's a really interesting journey for him as well. And music, I think, is really central to the show, from the needle drops to the composers that he's employed, including friends of the show, Daniel Pemberton, Max Richter, Clint Mansell, Ariel Marx. And since Charlie and I discuss this specific episode, we are going to begin with one of Clint's cues from San Junipero called Life Eternal. Charlie, how are you?
I'm all right. Can't complain, mustn't grumble. How are you?
Very good. It's very lovely to sit and eat my breakfast listening to you this morning on the radio. It's very nice. Do you have fun?
Mate, you didn't vomit the breakfast up as a result of my horrible voice laughing out of a speaker.
It was lovely. It was really good. And it was also a lovely addition to my research to chat to you today, to be honest. But I've watched all the episodes of the new season. Congratulations. It really is. It's kind of brilliant. And it's always the thing with Black Mirror, where you kind of have no idea where you're going to go with it. And it's just, you don't really get that with many things, I think, now, where the kind of anticipation and the unknown stepping in and everything. We always seem to know everything about everything before we watch it now. But with Black Mirror, it makes it quite unique like that.
Yeah, we deliberately tell you nothing.
Yeah.
If we can help it. Which often makes, when I'm out promoting the show, it's quite difficult for me to discuss.
Yeah, I want to put this out when people have had the opportunity to watch some episodes, because Spoiler free sort of thing, because having had the luxury of watching all the episodes and being a fan of the show, before we talk about music, if that's all right, which is such a big part of the show, both in terms of, you know, the composers that you use to the needle drops and things and songs that reappear. But for you, when you're thinking about starting a new series of Black Mirror, is there a starting point? Is there a thing or a stimulus that makes you sit down and write and think about a new season?
Not necessarily a season. When it comes to an individual story, it's really just, the best ones seem to occur just in the moment, and quite often as a bit of a joke. So there's one episode in this season where I was watching The Dropout, which was this show dramatizing the Elizabeth Holmes Theranos scandal, and it stars Amanda Seyfried plays Elizabeth Holmes in it. And I was watching it with my wife, and we're watching it at home, and we're sort of like, this feels like it happened 10 minutes ago and it's being dramatized already. And that then leads to sort of inevitably a comic conversation about, imagine if in this she switched the TV on and sees the dropout. And then you're like, okay, oh, okay, there's a story in that. Usually there's a funny idea occurs to me, and then actually with that particular episode, which is called Joan is Awful, it is a comic story. Quite often I'm taking an idea that's occurred to me as a funny idea and then making something horrible out of it.
Is that an easy journey for you?
Yeah. Well, I think I'm a natural sort of worrier. Mm-hmm. And so it doesn't take me many steps to go from, you know, if the kids are bouncing around on a trampoline, then I'm the person who's immediately picturing the public service information film version of that in there. Oh, someone's going to put their knee through the other one's face at the minute. It's all going to be, we're going to be rushing them to an A&E. Quick, stop them having fun. I'm that person. And so, you know, catastrophizing, I guess. So, you know, that's a hindrance in everyday life, but it's a benefit when you're thinking of sort of horrible ideas. And I think a lot of comedy, I mean, we're seeing at the moment, aren't there? There's quite a lot of comedy people who also do horror, so seem quite adept at doing horror material. I'm thinking of people like Jordan Peele or shows like Inside Number 9, which kind of walk.
Yeah.
And I think there's common ground. I think often in comedy, you're imagining what's the worst that could happen.
Yeah.
And then playing it for comic effect, and in drama and horror and disturbing stuff, you're kind of exercising a similar muscle.
And do you ever write with specific cast in mind as well? Because, you know, that's another brilliant part to this show is the casting and who you see. I mean, I would take me all day, to be honest, to list everybody in these episodes, these new episodes, even the tiny moments that they appear and stuff as well. I'm thinking of Nick and Demon 79, which is a brilliant throwback, by the way. So brilliant. But when you're writing, do you have people in mind? And I imagine you're at a point now with the show where you kind of, I imagine you've got that luxury where you could kind of go to anyone pretty much and go, do you want to be in Black Mirror? I mean, looking at the cast list in this, it's kind of pretty, yeah.
We've got a good cast. And again, we've got, I think, a nice mix of sort of like international faces and people who will be very familiar to Brits and some people who won't be too familiar to people necessarily. So, I mean, certainly, I'm just always amazed that people say yes, actually. So that's obviously really gratifying. I mean, I don't know if I could go to literally anyone. That would be quite a weird, that's quite a weird thought. That's way too much power to be wielding. Certainly, like, so Salma Hayek is in one of our episodes, and so that was an interesting thing where, and again, it's not too giving away too much to say she plays sort of herself in it, or kind of like a version of herself at points in that episode. And that's obviously a bit nerve-wracking if you're sending someone a script with their name in it and you're asking them to play themselves. Turned out she sort of couldn't get enough of it, and she actually encouraged us to ramp it up.
Oh, wow.
So my original version, because obviously you're not going to send some, if you've seen the story, there's things in there that you would never, that Salma Hayek encouraged, put it that way, that weren't necessarily in the first draft that you send her. She was like, oh, you know, I think the version of me should be heightened and can draw on, you know, things from my actual life, and you can make me quite venal and sort of say outrageous things. And so that was like, that was, you know, she was a really good sport.
Because with casting as well, not just with actors as well. I mean, Monica Dolan, I love so much. I think she's just one of our greats, and she's fantastic. And Loch Henry, so great. But directors,
you've done a Scottish episode, that.
Yeah, I went and grabbed my closest kilt and stuck it on whilst I was watching it. you know, it's not just casting the actors; it's directors and composers. That's part of matching those right people with those stories and the, you know, how much do you relinquish control in terms of once you cast a director in a way for each episode? And
well, it's not about relinquishing control so much as you. The good thing is that basically, as soon as the director's on board, they've obviously got loads of questions about the script. So they ask lots of questions. Sometimes they're questions I don't have answers to. And then I feel terribly inadequate for a moment and sort of feel like a kid who hasn't done his homework. And I'm like, you know, they'll say, at what point does this character make this decision or something like this? And I'm thinking, I actually don't know. But what happens is you, through the discussion, you then go away and you change things, you know, and sometimes they'll have notes and feedback on, you know, I think this character's getting a bit lost, or I don't understand this. So there's a constant, you know, when things are going well, it's a constant state of improvement. And that's all, it reflects well on me, because it means the finish, if the finished article is looks like it was more thought out than my terrible first draft, then great. So I stay involved in the process throughout, kind of at every stage. The one thing I do tend to do is when we're actually shooting, I don't always go to set, and I don't tend to interfere on set.
Yeah.
I think that's where the directors and the actors, that's a bit of a sort of sacred space, as it were, and you don't want to sort of stick your oar in. And then my favorite bit, probably in a way, of the whole process is the edit.
Awesome.
And all the sort of stuff, all the post-production stuff after that. Because in the edit, you can make huge changes to things. It's where you can fix problems, usually script problems. You can fix those, or there's elements, new elements of the story that can come out. You can do a lot in the edit. It's the sort of most important draft of the story. So that's my sort of favorite bit. And then all the stuff after that, all the post-production stuff of that, when you're doing the sound mix and the VFX and the visuals, that's a like really luxurious, indulgent phase. It does mean you watch the episodes about 900 times.
So when you get to order a really nice lunch as well, and sort of comfy sofa and whatever.
Oh, you say really nice lunch. Usually what it is you're exhausting like the same four options on delivery.
What about composers then? How has that kind of journey worked with composers throughout the, you know, throughout the show's kind of history? Because you've attracted an amazing collection, you know, of composers. We had Clint Mansell actually on the podcast talking about his episode, San Junipero, you know, back a few years ago. And you've got, And actually, Ariel Marx, I just spoke to recently for A Small Light, which I thought was absolutely phenomenal.
Right.
Who you've got on this new season with Volker Bertelmann, obviously, you know, Oscar winner, who's just the nicest man ever. How does that work, that side of things?
That process works. So Ariel, like literally, I think I had watched A Friend of the Family and Candy, which was another series. Like I watched both of those back to back and then realized it was the same composer. So sometimes I'm suggesting a name, and more often actually you find that, or there'll be various names in the frame and we're trying to find out who's available and usually, again, that will be the thing the director quite often suggests somebody. Often it's somebody they've worked with before, or it's somebody that, and they'll have, usually what happens is the director has an initial like call. Now it would be a Zoom call probably.
Yeah.
And they, you know, talk through the story. And then if it feels like that you're, you know, everyone's gelling, then you send them the sort of cut. And it's an interesting process. I often lack the language to describe what, that's the piece I find really difficult. If I'm trying to talk to a composer, I don't have the language to describe what I'm after. Do you know what I mean? Does that make sense? You know, I don't know what instruments are called, things like that. I'm terrible.
That can be really interesting, because they're almost the translator in a way, aren't they? Between the emotion and the technical side of it in a way. And it's so brilliant when you kind of think of, I mean, for example, if you'd taken San Junipero as an episode, and you'd given that episode to six composers, to hear how different that episode would have been with all their different interpretations of it.
That's reminding me, we did an interactive episode called Bandersnatch, and there's a point in that where the character walks into a branch of W.H. Smith and is choosing between two LPs, and depending on which one you choose, it soundtracks a montage that's coming up later on in the story. It's a fascinating thought. I guess in the future you'll be able to, I mean, it's a slightly depressing thought actually, but in the future you'll be able to choose, like, I want a more electronic soundtrack for this episode, or like the viewer would. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, it that way. In that way that you get the soundtracks for video games that react to what's happening in the moment.
Yeah, the gameplay. Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
There's a beautiful marriage, I think, in the way that the music, both with the composer's work, with the tracks that are in there, you know, and however they're used, whether they're used as an emotive thing or a tonal thing as well, like the when she's watching the charts and Demon 79 and that Boney M moment and stuff as well, and Papa's little wink to her and stuff. You know, it's just used so brilliantly, and he's a great character to live him through, I guess, is the way to kind of explain.
Yes, I think it's obviously, you know, music is extremely evocative, and so I mean, you mentioned San Junipero, and by the way, I like Clint. The one of the really exciting things where it was Clint Mansell. I was a huge Pop Will Eat Itself fan back in the day when I was a teenager. So I was delighted. Like,
did you fanboy out?
Yeah, I know. It was like, but elsewhere in that episode, we were playing. It plays a lot of music from the '80s, and with Demon 79, it's set in 1979. So you have a lot of fun listening to. One of the things I do if I'm thinking of a story that's set in a specific time frame, I'll sort of put a playlist together of music from that year, including stuff I wouldn't necessarily have listened to or whatever. And you find it suggests images to you. If you go, I'll go out for a run, which is something I never used to do. But nowadays, like anyone desperately trying to stave off the grave, I go jogging and stuff. Pathetic. And I'll be listening to music. And quite often you kind of see moments. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, absolutely.
Suggests. Sequences or something like that. So sometimes in the script it's very specific, like there. So it was very specific about Boney M. There's a bit later on where it's very specific about the music that's playing in a pub.
Yeah.
Later on where it's like, I don't like Mondays, and we get Hit Me With Your Rhythm Stick and stuff like that. And there's a sort of gag that's playing there.
Yeah, it's very good.
So sometimes it's super specific, and other times, because obviously you don't know then when you're writing it, are we going to be able to clear this? Sometimes it's very specific, and sometimes you sort of, again, you make a playlist and you play around in the edit and try different things.
And there's a couple of other really great moments in that as well, when the car kind of chase is going on and you've got these two different pieces of music connected to the characters as well, that kind of flips between the two. That's brilliant. And Bright Eyes,
our Garfunkel Bright Eyes, which I didn't realise, I don't think America is really familiar with that piece of music. I
traumatized from it. I can't watch Watership Down. I still can't watch it.
And that's Plague Dogs, which is the follow-up that's actually more horrible.
Really?
Oh yeah, yeah. Oh, maybe that could unlock Watership Down for you. You could
maybe okay.
Plague Dogs, and you go, oh, Watership Down. That's a walk in the park.
It's like therapy. I like it. Okay.
It's No, I know. So Bright Eyes is haunting, and it's sort of like a beautiful and delicate sort of piece of music. It sounds like it should be like really beautiful. The lyrics are incredibly dark. Like, he's talking about following the river of death downstream is like pretty much the second line of that song. So it's quite unsettling. And the episode opens with that almost playing at length. Like, I think it's almost the whole song pretty much plays out. And again, for me, that evokes, because I can remember... Because that was number one for what felt like forever at some point, around like late 78, 1979, something like that. So it sort of evokes a whole era, doesn't it? Sort of, it's like smell is meant to sort of, you know, take you back to certain things.
And, yeah.
And it does that too.
Absolutely. 100% it does that as well.
Is it a kind of dream?
With Beyond the Sea, with that episode, because obviously you immediately think of the different versions of that song as well, you know, that are out there. Did the song inspire the story at all, or the characters? Has that happened at all, where a specific piece of music has been a kind of catalyst or an inspiration for an episode specifically?
Sometimes it unlocks a big... So Not necessarily. So, I mean, the big one that I always remember is when I was writing San Junipero, which was set in the 1980s, I was going for a run and I was listening, and I'd made a playlist of music from around 86, 87. And Heaven is a Place on Earth by Belinda Carlisle,
yeah.
It sounds pretentious, but I suddenly sort of saw the ending. So it actually gave me the ending of that episode, Heaven is a Place on Earth. It was like perfect for what was going on in the story. So I was like praying we could clear it, and we could.
Ooh, baby, do you know what that's worth? Ooh, heaven is a place on earth. It's
That episode is set in like a sort of alternative 1969, and it was sort of more of a character point in a way. The episode, the story was always called in my head was either called Sea of Tranquility or Beyond the Sea. And I couldn't, and I think there is a show called Sea of Tranquility, annoyingly, that's coming out. So called it Beyond the Sea. And then obviously that was an obvious thing for me to go and listen to. And then that leads you to the original French version of it. I assume it's the original version. I think it is. And it seemed like a piece of music that character would listen to at the time. And then that music choice influences, there's a Jacques Brel track that plays later on in that, because again, it felt like the sort of thing that character would be listening to, because that character is a sort of debonair, you know, worldly, slightly sort of sophisticated, the town mouse versus country mouse, effectively. So it was, it sort of felt like something in a slightly performatively sophisticated way that character might be listening to.
La mer qu'on voit danser le long des golfes clairs a des reflets d'argent, la mer, des reflets changeants sous la pluie. La mer, au ciel d'été, confond ses blancs moutons avec les anges si purs, la mer. Bergère d'azur infinie, voyez près des étangs ces grands roseaux mouillés, voyez ces oiseaux blancs et ces maisons rouillées.
It broke me, that episode. Whoa. Really,
accomplished.
Oh my god, it was just like that. Oh, because you think it's, I mean, I'll say watch the episode, please, you know, tell people at the start of this episode of this podcast to make sure they watch things first, but you think it's going to go one way, you're like, oh, I know it's going to happen, and then you go, oh my god. Yeah. Oh, brutal. So brutal. It's interesting because I've been thinking about it so much. It's been great because I'm ducking back into previous episodes and things as well. But do you ever set out to,
encourage people to have conversations about things, because that's the great thing that the show does. It makes you think, it makes you talk about things, it makes you think about things. And anything I think they can do at the minute is like, it's got to be applauded. But do you ever kind of set out going, you know, if you're writing an episode going, I'd really like the theme to be this, or, you know, so tailoring it that way, or does it never really work that way for you?
I think it doesn't. And I think that I don't try. I always get a little, when people sort of say, oh, the show is a dark warning about this, that, like, I'm a little uncomfortable with that, because partly because I sort of think, I don't set out to hopefully the show to be preachy, but I do think that probably while writing it, I tend to be drawn towards things that are a little satirical, or there's a sort of horrible irony there, or sometimes you're just trying to evoke a sense of abject horror, and other times you're just trying to make people laugh. It depends. Sometimes yes, sometimes no, but I'm not necessarily trying to like beat the drum and say everyone talk about this. If it gives you sort of food for thought, then that's great.
Even like Demon 79, you know, set in 79 is just like, it's crying out that it could be present day in terms of the themes and what's going on and stuff as well. And that's such a clever thing that kind of really shines through from that episode particularly.
Hopefully, definitely. It's a bit like a sort of lost horror movie from 1979, but then at some point it's shot through with stuff that's happening now, so hopefully it is relevant. And obviously when you're, I think you can't escape any time in which you're writing things, you're going to be influenced anyway by the atmosphere and the things that are in your head, and they're in your head because of what's happening to you and around you, so it's always going to come through in that respect. And yes, that was an interesting thing to do this season, was to start out, and that episode goes out, it says Red Mirror, because I was going to be doing them all at one point as like almost horror companion alternative past episodes.
Okay.
Then I sort of course corrected and changed it back into Black Mirror, actually. But it's interesting that then, I'm delighted that was your takeaway from it, in a way, was that, I said takeaway, I don't like it when people say that. What was your takeaway? What was our takeaway from that story? Again, that's delivery,
connection to it, yeah,
yes. Was that it, you know, that it felt still, that it felt timely, because I think it was a way of me disrupting in a way what I was in danger of Black Mirror episodes becoming a cliche, that they were always about somebody who's trapped inside a computer, or who's got a thing attached to their, an electronic device attached to their temple that's enslaving them in some way. So I just sort of deliberately set out to sort of upend the formula, so to speak. And that's hence you get episodes like Demon 79, which are very different. They're very different to things we've done before, but hopefully still feels like a Black Mirror.
And it's also that thing as well, where you have this, you kind of think about things and you watch old episodes, particularly, you go, my God, Charlie can see into the future. He knows what's going to happen. It's kind of, you have this ability to almost kind of write about things that maybe we're subconsciously thinking about, that are around the world, that you write into these scripts or characters or situations that seem to occur or happen or are within reach. In terms of research for things, particularly when it is around technology stuff and things like that, do you dive into loads of research and speak to people?
In all honesty, no, I don't. I mean, and again, I sort of feel like, because when the show started back in 2011, there weren't that many other dystopian sort of sci-fi shows, and now it feels like there's quite a few. And so again, something I was trying to do was distinguish the show from those, or just make it feel a bit different from other things that were on. Again, I think there was a danger that the show was becoming a little bit, what's the tech issue of the week that you're going to write about? And somebody had said to me at one point, oh, are you going to do a Black Mirror episode about NFTs? And I thought, oh, that sounds so depressing. And so, no, really, I mean, I'm quite geeky and I'm interested in technology and I sort of follow what's going on, but I don't specifically sort of sit there and I don't open the technology pages and think, okay, how can I turn this into a story? And sometimes, weirdly, you can do too much research and find out that, oh, that would never, ever be possible, or you might find something that will dissuade you from doing the story. So I like to cheat and keep to our sort of movie magic rules.
Maisie Day's a great episode too. I really enjoyed that.
It's an odd one, that. Again, we can't say too much without spoiling it. But again,
I'll just call it the PAP episode.
A paparazzi episode is definitely the way to to look at that again. Like, there's a like a Red Mirror thing going on. I've been umming and ahhing over whether I designed a slightly different title sequence, which we put on, then took off, put on, then took off, and we took it off and made it, which goes out as a standard Black Mirror. We'll see if that was the right decision. And I'm very nervous about it. But it's an interesting, again, it's an interesting, I mean, it's set, the time it's set, it's just before smartphones basically became mainstream and made the paparazzi not irrelevant, but less, potentially less powerful, because suddenly everyone was potential paparazzi. So it's certainly an interesting time to set something.
Yeah, and it's interesting because there's almost like two narrative threads there, you know, in terms of the paparazzi on one side and then this kind of starlet on the other side of things as well. It's really great. I almost kind of like, oh, I want a feature of this.
We do. I mean, all the
they're good, hot, meaty episodes. It's great.
Well, hopefully that's part of the appeal for me is in doing something that's, we're a short commitment show anyway. We don't, you know what it's like that. And by the way, this is no, I'm not throwing shade, as the young folks say, at you know, episodic television, because you get shows like Succession or White Lotus or, you know, any, which are amazing. And, you know that thing where somebody says to you, oh, you've got to watch this show. It gets really good around season two. Okay, that's 10 hours of my life. But I know it will be. I know from experience that when you're really into a show, it's great. You can't stop sort of inhaling it. But it is a bit nerve-wracking now, isn't it? Because you're constantly like, it's when you're in between seasons of stuff, it's quite nerve-wracking. And it's a bit like, it's so much of your time potentially that you're going to invest in something. It's a bit like trying to work out where you should move house to. Like, oh, you know, it's a big commitment. And so the thing about Black Mirror is the stories live for as long as they live, which is one episode and then it's out and you're done. Mm. And so some of them, they are sort of mini features basically. And we treat them all, they're all treated individually. That's why hopefully each one is idiosyncratic and has its own character and tone, has its own composers, has its own directors, has its own cast. So they are sort of hermetically sealed in one respect, but also sort of part of this psychological whole. And I mean whole as in whole, not hole, although it is also a psychological whole. But it does mean that, like, hopefully it means you'll hopefully tune in. That's a helplessly outdated term, but you'll switch on and click, and then hopefully, yes, you go away feeling like you've got a full meal. You could watch one and then naff off and you're done. I'd obviously prefer it if you watched every single one and watched them three times so the algorithm says I've been a good boy.
Tell you what, when you were talking earlier about that idea of music can kind of almost like either like switch on a memory kind of card or whatever is going on in there. And you have that with this new season as well, because there's been the Irma Thomas track has been something that's reoccurred through a few seasons sort of thing. It's not every, you know, you don't have an every episode sort of thing, but it pops up and it's really small in this season, isn't it? It's like, and it's kind of, but it is almost like that. Oh,
there it
like
is.
Almost there it is. Yeah.
It's a little Easter egg. Well, in a way, and it was partly there because sometimes when you're writing, you realize, oh, okay, I can pop it in here like that. I can have a character humming it in the background or whatever. This time we were just hunting for a place for it to go in the season. And it went in really late, actually, really, really late. I was like, oh, we can put it in there. So it pops up in the background in an episode. And again, it's like, that's a sort of treat for long-term fans of the show or people who've seen lots of episodes so they can, it'll take them back to happy memories as well of other episodes.
I'll make you go, oh, I'm going to go watch that again for sure. Awesome. Get that algorithm up. Listen, it's a treat to get to chat to you about it. Really, really is. And I hope there's going to be more as well, because yeah, you tell great stories and you give us kind of characters. And as I said, there's nothing better than watching something and it making you think and starting a conversation. And yeah, it just makes you kind of go off and explore. So thank you so much, Charlie. It's been a real treat to get to chat to you about it. Thank you.
Thank you.
As used repeatedly in Black Mirror, too much beautiful and brilliant effect that anyone who knows what love is will understand, by Irma Thomas, rounding off this latest episode of Soundtrackin' with Charlie Brooker. My huge thanks to Charlie for taking the time to talk to us. You can watch the latest season of Black Mirror on Netflix now, and I highly recommend that you do so. It also encouraged me to go back and rewatch some of the old episodes as well. So it's a great thing, I guess, about having a lovely library of them available at your fingertips so you can dive in and out. And as I mentioned, we've spoken to quite a few of the composers that are featured on the show, and you can hear those conversations by just heading to edithbowman.com. You can also follow us on social channels. We are at Soundtrackin' UK. And why not check out our YouTube channel too for extra video content? I'm going to stick Charlie up actually before the weekend, so that'll be up there for you to watch. Next up, I've literally just got back from chatting to Mr. James Mangold, who is returning to Soundtrackin' for his second sitting, and specifically to talk about Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny. Now, if you listened to the previous episode of James, where he came on to talk about Logan, that phenomenal film that he did with Sir Patrick Stewart and Hugh Jackman. Amazing, amazing film. And James's career is brilliant and beautiful and exciting to watch, because as you'll hear him talk about in the chat on the next episode, he kind of defies expectations when it comes to director, and that he just kind of wants to flit around and try different things, and he's a film fan at heart, so that's why he wants to try and do different types of films. Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny, I actually held the premiere last night, and I'm not going to lie, I had a little cry after I spoke to Harrison Ford, who was so energised and so excited and proud of this last episode, chapter in the Indiana Jones saga, I guess. And yeah, for me, you see, because Indiana Jones was the very first film that I chose to go and see at the cinema, Indiana Jones the Temple of Doom, so it had real emotional context for me. Anyway, I love James Mangold. He is such a treat to chat to. His enthusiasm is infectious, and I really hope that you can join us for our next episode of Soundtrackin' with James Mangold.
Than just pain relief? At Ability Chiropractic, we help your body do what it was designed to do, heal naturally. Our doctors focus on spinal and nervous system alignment to restore balance, energy, and overall wellness. From infants to grandparents, families across Columbus are discovering that true health starts from within, not from a prescription bottle. Experience what natural healing can do for you. Book your appointment today at abilitychiro.com. That's abilitychiro.com.
During the Right Rug Flooring Anniversary Sale, we're celebrating 91 years of the guaranteed lowest prices. With beautiful carpet with a lifetime stain warranty starting at $219 a square foot installed with pad. And luxury vinyl starts at $399 a square foot installed. Unbeatable prices and 24-month special financing available with approved credit. Schedule a free in-home appointment with our flooring experts at RITERUG.com. Right Rug Flooring's Anniversary Sale.
Right here, right now.
Veterans salutes those who served. Veterans Ride Free Tuesday, November 11th. And every other day of the year, our veterans and active duty military personnel get a 50% discount on all fares. It's all part of COTA's ongoing commitment to show appreciation for your selfless service. To ride at no cost on fixed routes, tell your bus operator that you're a veteran or use code VET2025 in the app to use COTA Plus. Veterans Ride Free on Tuesday, November 11th for Veterans Day. Veterans get a 50% discount every day on COTA. Plan your ride and learn more at coda.com/trip planner.